Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Today we're going to take some time and deal with some real life challenges that some of our listeners are having relating to the aging process. And many of these relate to legal questions. So we thought this is a good time to do a show in which we do a Q&A. We've already had the questions submitted to us over the past, 2 weeks or so. Mm-hmm. And we want to deal with these understanding that the people asking these questions probably represent a number of you out there. So we want this show to be practical and helpful. So let's plunge in, Susan.
All right. Our first question comes just in a little bit more for explanation is, what is the difference between guardianship, conservatorship, power of attorney? These are all words that are one of our listeners hears, but we need to have a better understanding on.
Well, and this comes up a lot. I mean, think of it this way. Whenever you're an adult, the law gives you the benefit of the doubt that you're capable of managing your affairs. That's a fair assumption. In other words, you get to choose each day where you go, what you do. You're responsible for managing for your expenses, you know, for getting your car insured, for driving responsibly and all those things. But what happens when suddenly that assumption is no longer accurate, meaning that the person, due to aging or other issues, it could be a health crisis, but they're no longer capable on a mental level of making those decisions. Well, the problem is that because they're an adult, no one has the legal authority to sign things on their behalf, mm-hmm. no more than they were before they had that incident. So just like for each of us listening, someone cannot simply decide that they're going to sign your name on deeds, on
checks,
on security accounts, on bank accounts, etc. So in order for that power to exist, there has to be some legal tool that gets us there. Now, there are two ways to get there. One can be voluntary, which means where you do a power of attorney. And a durable power of attorney is a simple piece of paper or maybe a couple of pieces of paper in which you give someone the power in the event that you become incompetent. That's the legal word that's used. In the event that you become incompetent, then that person can pick up and make those decisions for you. They can turn around, they can buy real estate for you, they can sell it, they can pay your bills, they can collect your debts. They can do all those things that you would do with a few limitations. So this is a very powerful tool you'd be giving somebody, so you don't want to award it casually. You want to award somebody you really care about. But the point is that takes place without going to court, without a hearing, et cetera. So in the question you asked me, what is the difference between a guardianship, conservatorship, power of attorney? The power of attorney is a document that allows you to avoid going to courts, paying lawyers to represent you and all that. However, if you haven't done that, I mean, think about that example we were talking about. You know, suddenly the assumption you have about an adult's no longer valid. So now what do you do? Well, there has to be a legal means to accomplish that. They're incompetent now. They can't sign a power of attorney anymore. So now there's only one option left, and that's where you have to go to court, have a hearing, have doctors testify, and have a guardian appointed, typically guardian ad litem it's called, to investigate. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the court's gavel will go down, and there will be a ruling, presumably, that there's an appointment of a guardian who's a person who's in charge of their physical person, not the person who manages the assets. So there would be a guardian appointed, and then separately from that, there'd be a conservator appointed. And as you might guess, conservator means the person who manages the stuff,
right?
You know, the real estate. And that kind of makes sense. Often the person that has the skill set to be the guardian may not have the skill set to be the conservator. So anyway, no one that I know of wants to get to a solution that way. So people prefer to have a durable power of attorney. It's much cheaper, and it's much more efficient than the very expensive, often very expensive, process of having a guardian or conservator. But it's the only alternative if you have to have somebody making decisions.
Well, then this next question comes from one of our listeners who actually did have the power of attorney in place, but they have a question about it. So here's their question from Kevin. He says, can a nursing home allow or refuse to allow my family to transfer my father to another facility if I have power of attorney? We were told that because my sister is the one who actually placed him in the facility, that only she can approve the transfer. Is that right?
So wait, now, if there is a durable power of attorney in place, then I'm wondering how the sister had the authority, assuming dad is incompetent. Now, I don't know that, do we?
It doesn't say.
Okay. See, if dad is competent, then he can make his own decision, and which may be helpful here, maybe not. but if dad is incompetent, then, of course, whoever holds that durable power of attorney. So I'm wondering, his daughter that got him there, did she simply sign his name, or did he sign it? Was he competent at the time? And so he signed it. Now he's not competent. And so the nursing home, for whatever reason, is thinking that since they've interacted perhaps most with the daughter, that they should look to her. But the bottom line is, if the son holds a durable power of attorney, he holds the ability to arrange payment or non-payment of this nursing home. And I can tell you, directly or indirectly, that's going to get the cooperation of them eventually. Because
right.
if he cuts off payment, which he can do, unless it's coming from a third party. And even that, he could cut off on behalf of the dad. So I would think that the son really has more power than he realizes, and he certainly has the power to contract with the other institution.
So he needs to just take the bull by the horns and make the decision, it sounds like.
Yeah, he may have. This may be one of those cases, and it occasionally happens with powers of attorney, because remember, this is taking place outside the legal system, you know, where a piece of paper is signed, and as you might imagine, there are occasional glitches in that process. So sometimes it does require hiring a lawyer. But believe me, even in that case, it's much simpler than the guardianship conservatorship approach.
Right. Okay, continuing with our power of attorney questions, this one comes from Sandra, and she says, I am an agent under a durable power of attorney for a friend with a challenging form of dementia. I can no longer serve as her agent, and she has no other friends willing to do it. What are my options?
That raises a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you that there are a few states out there that will allow the holder of a durable power of attorney to identify their successor.
Oh, okay.
And that's unusual. But there are some that permit that, on the theory that person is using the same judgment that they were vested with on the part of the principal in this case. The person who gives the power of attorney would be the person called the principal, and the person who uses it is called an agent. So the principal trusted the judgment of their agent, and so their agent in those states are allowed to transfer it. I have to admit that, because I haven't seen this question in a while, I don't remember if Missouri is one of those states that would permit that, but I do know the answer in the absence of that. In the absence of Missouri being that minority of states that would not allow the appointment of a successor, then there would have to be a hearing and there would have to be an appointment of a guardian or conservator. Now, one other avenue would be to move for the court to interpret the document to identify a successor. And I'm sure the court would be cooperative with that. So I guess the first approach is, unfortunately, they have to go to a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But when they go to the lawyer, the question of the lawyer should be, I want to bring a proceeding for the identification and appointment of a successor trustee. And the court, I'm pretty confident, would be willing to have a hearing on that question alone for purposes of an appointment. And that's very different from appointing a guardian or conservator. Remember, they're under the thumb of the court. They have to appear regularly. And not to mention, the process of appointment is expensive and inefficient. So I like this idea as a solution.
So she can find a replacement. It's just going to take a few steps and going to have to the courts involved.
I think they would, but I think she can avoid a guardianship here.
Right. Okay, great. All right, let's move on. A few weeks ago, we actually talked about trusts. And so we have a question here that says, we are getting ready to draft a trust. They obviously took our advice. We have one son, so he will be the trustee. What is the best way to make sure that he follows the rules set forth in the trust? We've read about nightmares and trust protectors, financial managers and advisors that control the investments, companies that control the trust and trust managers, but we have no other relatives, and they just want to make sure that one person can handle all of that.
Well, I don't know that the answer is going to give the sort of confidence level that they would like. But you know, look, this is the environment in which estate planning occurs. I mean, estate planning, elder planning, often occurs in an imperfect environment where you may have to live with some risks and some uncertainty that you wouldn't like. But it's the nature of the world, and I encourage clients to plan as best they can, and then let go. In other words, be sure that they've done the best they can do, but then let go, because mm-hmm. otherwise you can just spend the rest of your days here worrying about your stuff and worrying about, is my plan safe enough, secure enough? Have I eliminated all possibilities for my plan to not work perfectly, to work perfectly? And so I think that at the end of the day, you've got to make a decision, and that's that you're going to plan well and then go from there. But let me answer more specifically the question. I think that there's a posting of a bond that's typically done. I think that is useful. That from a financial standpoint, that can be very powerful. The beneficiaries, remember, have a means of enforcing and, in fact, bringing action against whoever this trustee is. So to the extent we're talking about beneficiaries other than in this case, the what would be called the grantors, the people who are making the trust, and, mm-hmm. and there are, of course, successor beneficiaries, which I'm sure are others, perhaps their son too. I'm sure he's one of the beneficiaries, but he's also a trustee. So in that case, then I think the primary concern is going to be how good will his care be for them during their lifetime, and will he manage the assets in the way he should? The fact that this question's being asked, I'm thinking this through as I'm talking, and this is incidentally the way lawyers deal in the real world. You could tell that this show is not scripted.
We're not scripted.
No, we're not scripted. What I'm deducing from this is there's one child, right?
Right.
And presumably he's going to be the remainder, we'll call remainder beneficiary. So he's caring for his parents, and they have a discomfort. I'm trying not to use the word distrust.
Well, that was kind of my thought too, is that perhaps they're a little bit uncomfortable with their son having all of either that responsibility or all of that control. And maybe they're wondering what some of those other options are.
Yeah, I get it. I think that, I think based on the tone of the question, maybe the son's not the right guy. Mm-hmm. Maybe it should instead be another party. Now, they mentioned that they had familiarity with the trust protector, and trust protectors, for those of you who haven't heard that phrase before, it's where you can actually have someone appointed who's to stand on the sidelines as a sort of referee or someone prepared to call foul in the event that the trustee does something that he or she shouldn't. So trust protectors have certain powers to intervene under certain circumstances is what it means. They don't run the trust like a trustee does. But they can be a useful tool, and they are acknowledged and enforceable in Missouri. So the question suggested that perhaps the questioner, just felt that maybe that was just too complicated. But I think that unless they're going to have a trust protector overseeing the son, unless I had that, if I were in their shoes, then I would choose someone else other than the son. I just wouldn't use him if I had those reservations. And the trust protector is probably the single best means to do that, to enforce it.
And the son can still be a beneficiary. I think sometimes people get that confused a little bit, that it has to all be one person. But the son can still receive income from the trust itself, correct?
Yeah, I will tell you that there's this thing called, and I'm not wanting to get too technical here, but there's a thing called the merger doctrine. So if the trustee and the beneficiary, if there were only one person who is a trustee and only one person who is a beneficiary, then the merger doctrine says that it goes away. But to the extent there are children of the son or there are contingent beneficiaries, even that's enough to allow the trust to continue. So I'm assuming there's someone named after the son, but a word of caution to these questioners would be be sure that it's not simply the son that's left unless they intend for the trust to disappear thereafter or have another trustee.
Okay. We have time for maybe one more question before our break. So let's see. We have a question from Andrea, and she says, my father was a resident of Arkansas. So maybe you're not familiar with Arkansas, but he passed away recently. I am the beneficiary of my father's individual retirement account. Now, my mother is also in a nursing home in Arkansas. And what Andrea would like to know is, does the IRA need to be used to pay for the care of my mother, who has an illness and is in a nursing home?
Very interesting. The mother is surviving.
Yes.
The father died.
Yes.
And it's his IRA.
Yes.
And it was left to the mother.
It was left to the daughter, Andrea.
And so she's wondering, does she have a legal obligation?
That's what she would like to know. Is, does she have a legal obligation to pay since her mother is on Medicaid? Does she have to use that IRA to pay for the expenses for her mother?
Certainly not. I mean, there's no obligation on her part regarding the mother. Now, I thought it was going to be the more interesting question of.
Well, then tell us that one.
Okay, I'll change the question, and that's where the father had been in a nursing home, and had incurred Medicaid benefits, for example, and now the rules under Medicaid are pretty clear. They have what's called asset recovery, so they can claim assets when you die that may have been exempted while you're alive. Some states exempt, like the IRA, of the person who's institutionalized. So they will, they'll leave that alone until the death, and then the death they can claim this asset recovery, which means repayment for whatever benefits they handed out. So if they handed out $100,000 worth of benefits, then they can say, okay, now it's time for payback, and that payback can be in the form of a house they owned, or it can be in the form of other assets. That's what I thought was the question, but I think this is pretty clear. If it's left to the daughter, the daughter certainly has no obligation to use that for the mother.
Okay. But if it is left to the mother, then they can go after the recovery, I guess.
They depending on Arkansas law regarding tax-deferred assets. Okay, let's take a break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
We're back. Let's continue with the question and answers, real world challenges that our listeners face.
Well, I was talking with someone last week, and they were telling me about a situation with their aunt. And the story is, the aunt and her husband were married 44 years. The husband, it was a second marriage, and he had children from his first marriage. And he was 15 or 20 years older than my friend's aunt. Well, now what's happened is he has passed away, and the aunt has inherited the money. Hmm. But the children have power of attorney and are not wanting to help pay for this woman, even though they're her stepmother. Everything's been going along fine, but there's a sense, at least in her perspective, that the kids are trying to maybe up their inheritance a little bit more by keeping her away from some of the money that she needs to live on. Help, Joe Cordell.
Doesn't this have all the ingredients of those cases we hear about where there's disputes between stepkids and stepmom or stepdad? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that a number of our listeners are thinking, well, I can see that. And some of our listeners are thinking, I might potentially be in a situation like that. So it is a fact. I mean, we live in a world in which there are these successor marriages. And, mm-hmm. and it's not necessarily due to divorce. I mean, often a spouse will die and the survivor will remarry. And then there are stepkids. So, and in fairness to the stepkids, sometimes their relationships are better than others with stepmom. And sometimes it starts out, what I've seen a lot with clients is where maybe it started out okay, where the kids, if you had asked them on the day of the funeral of their parent what their relationship was with step-parent, they had talked very fondly of their step-parent. And then, and we'll assume it's the mom or the stepmom. So then you fast forward 6 months, a year, maybe 2-3 years even, and you know the kids' visits kind of trail off, and maybe they never were that close, and you know the hustle of day-to-day living and whatnot, such that they can't get to visit as often as perhaps they would like.
And they lost the common bond that they shared between the dad that was there.
Yeah, yeah, that important connection. So without any malfeasance necessarily on anybody's part, mom comes to resent that. So she often will think, well, maybe I'm not going to include you in the way that I otherwise would have in my will, especially if they trail off entirely, which sometimes happens. So it's not shocking to us. It shouldn't be that things like this happen, but we have to plan for them. So now let's talk about this situation. You said that dad had died, so he leaves the assets to stepmom, which more often than not happens. And then the stepkids, he apparently gave, or mom gave, a power of attorney to. Now, that's a little unusual, especially if she had any reservations about them. So it turns out that, and the questioner here appears to be a relative of stepmom, who feels that she's standing back and she's watching this, and she's thinking, you know, stepmom is not maybe competent anymore, is she, do you think?
Well, I think she is. I think she just needs some assistance at the
moment. She's vulnerable.
But exactly.
Okay, let's stick with the word vulnerable. So stepmom is competent but vulnerable, and she has trustingly given this durable power of attorney to the stepkids. Well, if I could do a rewind on this, there are some things I would suggest differently. And in the interest of being helpful to our listeners, let's take time and engage in that exercise. So let's rewind.
Okay.
And so stepmom is doing some planning, and her husband, now deceased, father of these kids, are doing planning. So I think whenever the suggestion is made or the intention is expressed to leave everything to stepmom, that is a noble thing and perhaps a good thing. In fairness to the kids, maybe a better way to do it would be to have put the money into an irrevocable trust where there's a third party as trustee, and that would have been easy to set up without spending a ton of money, because it would have been revocable during dad's lifetime. So he sets up a trust that doesn't bind him. It's revocable. But the moment he dies, it becomes irrevocable. Okay. And then he appoints a trustee that in the structure of a trust, there's a lot more control than there is in simply a durable power of attorney. So a trust, you know, has these very formal obligations, and the law imposes this very, very solemn responsibility on it, what's called a fiduciary. So it's a much more structured way to say, okay, while mom's alive, while my wife is alive, I want to be sure that she has all the money she needs. And yet I'm going to put it in a structured environment so that, you know, at least it's not dissipated. And then whatever's left will be given to the children. That would have prevented the sort of conflicts we have here, and it probably would have been a fair strategy for the kids in defense of them. I think that dad's plan would have potentially left them with nothing, although some dads may have intended that, you know? Right. I mean, there's this school of thought among loving parents. One school of thought says that, you know, the best thing you do for kids is let them make it on their own. And there's that other school of thought that says, no. You worked your entire life. You know, you did this for a reason, and one of those primary reasons was because I want to make my kids' life better than ours. So depending on which philosophy this dad had, you know, who knows? But anyway, he leaves it all to his wife, and the wife now makes big mistake number two, and that's that she appoints people who would have a conflict of interest naturally to have a power of attorney, and even more so, not only is there a conflict of interest, but these are not natural kids. So the risk is compounded. You might do that with your kids where still there's a conflict of interest, but many parents are okay with that. But in this case, it was really not good judgment to do it this way. And you wonder what was the context in which this was done. And I can imagine this train going off the track, really, in the ways in which I've indicated here a couple of ways, perhaps in a single meeting with a single lawyer at one point in time when when the husband and wife are doing their planning, and they plan in such a way that they want to do a complete plan. So they probably paid a single price mm-hmm. that included the durable powers of attorney, that included the wills for each of them, et cetera. So there probably was, you know, a little bit of hopeful thinking, and maybe they wanted to avoid conflict at that stage, even between dad and between the husband and wife. So the wife may have acquiesced to the same holders of this durable power of attorney as the husband had.
And with the hope that everything's going to be fine and it's all going to work out fine.
Yeah. But I imagine that was the context in which this happened. So there's some object lessons here in several places in this story for our listeners to take note. Now, what about the fact that we believe that the kids may be not using the assets fully to protect mom? There are a couple of things. There's no evidence based on this that mom is incompetent. Mm-hmm. So technically, mom has the ability, when I say mom, I mean the stepmother. Mm-hmm. Stepmother has the ability to rescind this. She can abolish it. She can declare it void and draft a new one. It's a little difficult to notify places of that. But once she notifies in writing the agents, in this case, the agents are the stepkids. Once she notifies them in writing that they have had their powers rescinded, that the documents no longer are valid, then to the extent they proceeded then, it would be fraud. So I'm going to impute to them that they're not going to do something criminal.
Right.
So that would be the way to notify them, as well as any parties who are relying on that, who she knows has been given copies of that durable power of attorney. She should also send them a copy of at least a letter rescinding the previous power, but also a copy of the new power. So the new power is I think, a critical ingredient in this plan. It means identifying someone that she does trust. Now, let me add this, too. There's a better way to have done this, too, which would have been that there would be a springing power. A power of attorney doesn't necessarily have to come into effect immediately. So for those of you who are listening and thinking, wow, maybe the lesson here for me is I can't trust anybody mm-hmm. with this sort of authority. And granted, it is scary to give someone the power to essentially spend all your money in your accounts and sell your real estate and invade your retirement. I mean, all these very scary sources of authority. But the whole idea is you give it to somebody you trust. And another thing you can do is, while if you didn't provide otherwise, it would go into effect at the moment that you sign it. It doesn't mean the person is using it. It just means they could. So some people like that because it doesn't mean you have to have a panel or doctors or someone later who certifies that you know something's developed and events occurred that now has triggered the power. That latter example is called a springing power, and that should be easy to remember. Springing means that it's not in effect when it's signed. Mm-hmm. But it springs into effect when some event occurs, which means mom's incompetence. And that can occur in a number of ways. It can occur through a panel of a couple of doctors certifying to that. It could even be a panel of family members. There's no limit as to how you can have that event documented. But there does need to be some way in which that can be clearly declared in an official way that the event has occurred. Because banks wouldn't know, brokerage houses wouldn't know, realtors wouldn't, if you have a condition there that there's no certification that the events occurred. For that reason, some people like to just not have that. They like to pick somebody they trust. Maybe it's one of their kids that they feel complete peace about transferring this authority, and they don't have a springing event. So the power's in effect immediately. But one point I'd make here for our listeners is there could have been a springing effect in this case, which it wouldn't have gone into effect until, in fact, the stepmom is incompetent. Another thing to point out here, though, is that whenever you give this power, it's not as if this person has carte blanche to do what they want and you don't have recourse. For what it's worth, it's important for the people to know that a person who holds a power of attorney, at least in the state of Missouri and most states, is they're a fiduciary. And a fiduciary is not simply a responsibility to be taken lightly that can be blown off and interpreted in a way that favors the person, your agent in this case. A fiduciary is quite the opposite. It means that you have to go to extraordinary lengths to avoid what's called self-dealing, mm-hmm. to engage in any activity that at all is self-serving. I mean, it's a very solemn, huge responsibility that the law takes very seriously, and there can be huge consequences. There can be civil liability. There can be criminal liability. So I'm not suggesting that this is enough to protect, you know, you if you hand this out casually, but I am saying that it is a serious incentive for people who have the power to not abuse it.
Well, and that kind of ties in a little bit with one of our other questions that's come in. This particular listener has power of attorney, and mom has not been declared incompetent, but mom has a diagnosis, a mental illness, but she's not incompetent. She just makes what he calls questionable judgment. Well, she's decided now that she doesn't want to pay her bills, and he wants to pay the bills, mom's bills, with mom's money. Can he do that? Or if she decides that she doesn't want to, can she take legal action against him because he's not acting in her best interest for what she thinks is her his best interest?
Yeah, well, the good thing about this is that that is the circumstance for which this device is designed. Mm-hmm. You know, when the principal, remember, that's the person that gives it away, when the principal is no longer competent to make their own decisions.
But it doesn't have to be some sort of a legal declaration that she's incompetent. Is that correct?
Yeah, not at all. However, okay, if a conflict develops, it could end up in court. Mm-hmm. I mean, the power of attorney does assume that this is a voluntary relationship. So if mom is in fact incompetent and she's saying, no, you don't have a power of attorney, I'm rescinding it, then that's a messy situation. And yes, it could end up in court. Because no one has certified that mom's incompetent in the way that's going to bind her. So I think that in that case, the good news is, yes, the son can go ahead and pay whatever expenses he needs to pay to protect mom. But if mom fights him and says that he doesn't have that authority, then they may end up in court. Now, remember what I was talking about a few moments ago, the springing versus the power that's in effect now. I'm assuming that this power is in effect now.
Right, it is.
All right, time to take a break. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
We're back. Now, Susan, do you have another question to field?
I do. We have just one more question that I want us to kind of camp on and stay a little bit for. A lot of these questions that we have taken have been involving people that live in St. Louis and maybe have relatives or an in-law or something in another state or another part of Missouri. But I have this situation. You have this situation. We have relatives close to us that aren't necessarily living in St. Louis. What is the best way that we can help them and be involved in the elder care decision making so that we can help benefit them, but yet we don't live right around the corner? So what do we do?
Well, and before we get into that, I mean, it's worth mentioning that it's frustrating when we get a lot of questions, several of which we've seen this morning from listeners who have family members in other states, mm-hmm. kind of like you describe. And so we have these questions about some things relating to Arkansas law, and we've had Florida law, and unfortunately some of those things are different. Mm-hmm. So it does require that you have someone on the ground locally with some expertise in the law in that state, because there is variation from state to state. So let me kind of, I'll use as a springboard for this discussion the scenario that I've been dealing with. I have an aunt and uncle in Louisville, mm-hmm. and they're in their mid-80s. My aunt is not in very good condition. I mean, she's very frail. My uncle has type 2 diabetes. He's recently had to have a couple of toes removed, and he's a little disoriented, so we're not sure how well he's going to come around. And the bottom line is that even if he does come around cognitively, I'm concerned that living at home, they're not capable of making the decisions they need to make on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? I mean, when my aunt and uncle, who I should add here, have no children.
Okay.
So they would look to either me or my brother, neither of whom live in Louisville. So we've been grappling with this. How do we assure that they're getting the proper care and decisions are made correctly on the ground in another city? And something tells me a number of our listeners are in a similar situation. Mm-hmm. So one comment I would make is that the way I've approached this is I recognize that there need to be resources from a couple of different directions. you know, there needs to be an attorney, an elder law attorney in Louisville, which we've contacted, somebody who's capable of making decisions there regarding what needs to happen from a legal side to be sure the documents like we've discussed today are in place.
Let's say that again. You're an elder care attorney, and yet you still feel like it's important to have someone in the same vicinity and in the same town where your relatives are that you can trust who will help them with the elder care law issues.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm a big believer in having someone who focuses in that area of the law, which, I mean, I think elder law is very unique. It's not estate planning, certainly not general practice. So I would want somebody who's an elder lawyer, but I'd also want somebody who's an elder lawyer in Kentucky,
right,
because those laws are different. So we've lined that up. We've arranged for that meeting. Another resource we lined up, which I think is hugely helpful for listeners, is a care manager. I mean, these are often nurses. Almost always they're nurses as their bachelor's degree is, but often they'll have a graduate degree and maybe social work or something else. But these are people who have their own practices, or maybe they work with a company that focuses on providing this sort of expertise, or consultants. They're kind of like consultants. They bill on an hourly basis to sort of stage manage a lot of this care. I mean, think about it. If you are in one city, your loved one's in another, there's lots of stuff that needs to be decided, and it doesn't all fit a single description, meaning there will be decisions that will relate to direct medical care. There will be decisions relating to equipping the home, being sure that things are in the home to make it safe. There's decisions relating to assuring that the proper people are coming into the home to assure that those ancillary services, which that list grows over time, that the providers of those services are there, that the people you love are, if they're not in an institution, that they're at home and that they're doing the things they're supposed to be doing. There's no guarantee of that, at least if they're frail.
As simple as daily hygiene, medications, all of those things can just become huge when you're not there to help oversee it.
Yeah, you can't just drive over in the morning before work like you could. I know some of our listeners may do that, in fact, or have children that do that. So I've found that this profession of, sometimes they're called geriatric care managers, it's worth looking them up. And I did. I looked them up. I found a resource in Louisville, some members of this organization, and I met the lady at my aunt and uncle's house, and I interviewed her and introduced her to them. And she's a nurse, and she's very smart, and all she does is this. And now her billing rate was like $95 an hour. So that may sound like a lot, but let me hurry to add that they don't use her all the time. I mean, her role is to come in periodically, and although she will offer and encourages that she be allowed to go with them to a doctor's appointment, because she wants to hear what's being said so she can explain it to them again later, which I'm doubtlessly they will need to hear again, even if they're clear at that point.
Well, and with a nursing background, she's going to hear things a little bit differently than what I might hear them.
Absolutely. And you're right. That's a huge factor. So I encourage them to pay the additional money to have her go with them to these doctor's appointments. But then otherwise, she might drop in a couple of times a month. And it can be less, it can be more, whatever people want. But her role is, she's not going to be in there doing hands-on care. There are generally less expensive people to do that. And so you only want to pay for this care manager at a high level of decision-making. So I really am looking to her primarily as the resource to tell me what's going on in these various other spheres. Whenever she's at the house, she looks around the house to be sure that the housekeepers are doing things correctly, or that the people who are coming in to assist with them in some other way are being diligent. She can observe them, you know, their demeanor, their behavior. I mean, it's so important when you don't have feet on the ground yourself, and you can't see and hear these things yourself, that you have someone there whose judgment you trust. And that's kind of what a care manager does. And it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. So in their case, a couple times a month, maybe a doctor's visit. So I'm not being dismissive at all about $300, $400, $500 a month. But I am saying that when you consider that door number one no longer exists, and door number one is saying, I don't have any costs like that in my life.
Right.
You know, that was, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you didn't have costs like that in your life. But that door doesn't exist anymore.
Well, and door number two might be a higher rate of having to have more assisted care or more assistance on a daily basis. And if you can minimize that, then that $400 is $400 well spent.
It is. And now let me hurry to add, there is some long-term care insurance that will pay for some of that. So I don't want to exclude the possibility that's going to be paid for by some third-party payor, but it's not clear that it will be in their case. So I'm telling the people who are listening who can at all afford it that sort of person, it's money well spent, even if you can't find a third-party payor to pay for it. But I will hurry to add that sometimes insurance will pay for it. And under very special circumstances, it's possible to get Medicare or Medicaid to pay for it, but those are relatively narrow set of circumstances. So it's great if you meet them, but you probably don't.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, for me, that was very important. And another resource that is going to turn out to be important is we chose a franchise called Right at Home. Now, I have no relationship with these people. We did just research reviews online. But many of our listeners know there are a lot of these franchises out there that focus on providing unskilled, meaning by unskilled, I just mean people who are not medical professionals.
Right.
But these are people who will do housekeeping, they'll prepare meals, and they only do light housekeeping normally. These are not quote-unquote housekeepers.
Right.
These are people who...
They're not going to do your windows.
Yeah, exactly. Their job is to come in and help older people
right.
with the stuff that older people need help with that don't require a medical professional. So they can help them get in and out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
They can remind them to take their medicine. They can't give them the medicine, but they can remind them. They can feed them.
Hmm.
They can prepare food, drive their cars, take them places. In other words, this kind of all-purpose, relatively low-paid person to come in and take care of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm looking at my aunt and uncle in Louisville, I'm thinking, you know, what are the things I need to have in place? And that was an area that was vacant until I figured out a way to solve it. And for me, it was identifying one of these agencies, Right at Home, one of these companies, Right at Home. But again, there are a bunch of them out there.
Now, do they have the same person that comes each week? So they develop a bit of a relationship with her? I mean, that's a plus right there.
Yeah, we met with them when we were in Louisville recently. We met with them, spent a couple of hours getting to know them, and they brought in the manager as well as the person who'd be working there. And you're right, that's an important component, is they want somebody who's going to develop a relationship and with whom my aunt and uncle are going to feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So, but these people, again, they're not real cheap. They're about $22 an hour in that market,
mm-hmm.
and that's standard in that market. So if I had called Visiting Angels, Senior Care Services, I mean, this variety out there, I think I would have, based on my research, the numbers would have been very similar. So keep in mind when you're talking about this service, it's probably not something that you would have 40 hours a week. Again, in some cases, Medicaid will pay for this. In some cases, in very narrow cases, Medicare might, but I think they have to be a certified home care agency for Medicare that's going to pay for it. There's some long-term care insurance that'll pay for it.
Right.
And remember the incentive. The incentive is it saves insurance companies money, because if you can't get this stuff at home, what are you likely to do? You're going to end up in a nursing home.
Right.
So I think that it's in everybody's interest, including insurers, to pay out the relatively low amount of money to provide you this rather than have you turn to the alternatives. So, but again, people who are considering this, they need to keep in mind that it'll be around $22 an hour. And I think the Louisville market's probably similar to a number of markets in the Midwest, certainly. And think of it as something that may be as little as 5 hours a week. Some people have them come in an hour a day, and their tasks, the things they need, will be different from another person's. But some will do 15 hours. You get a price break when you get up to 15 hours a week or so. Pretty much all the companies do this in some form or another. There's a point at which you get a price break.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a big break. You might go from $22 an hour to 20.
But
the bottom line is, I believe in this industry. I think it's serving an important purpose. You just have to check out any particular one that you use. Most of them are franchises. And so a lot of the quality of the franchise is determined by the owner locally. But remember, one reason you trust franchises is there is a lot of central control. the processes and systems, like with a McDonald's. It's mm-hmm. you know, whether your hamburger's good has less to do with the local person than you're betting on McDonald's,
right.
the company. So there's a lot of that in this too. But I just think that this industry fulfills an important role, and you just have to be willing to pay for that.
Well, and if you have someone, let's say 15 hours a week, I mean, that's roughly 3 hours a day, Monday through Friday. I mean, that helps open up, they can get you breakfast. They can take care of just keeping your house in order, get those dishes put away, maybe run you to the grocery store so that you can do those things. Maybe even get your lunch ready to go. I mean, that's really kind of a lot of time, really, that mm-hmm. you are helping and you are keeping someone in their home so that they're not having to go to an assisted living or whatever the next level would be.
Yeah.
And it really does have a vital service.
And once you retain one of these companies, then you can call them on short notice, meaning it's okay if something pops up, if you need them on a holiday or just within a few hours, they can have somebody there. It may not be your person, your mm-hmm. normal person, but once you become a client, then they want to fulfill your short-term needs. If you use them on holidays, which you can, it's more expensive, mm-hmm. but a number of people will use them on holidays.
But if you have a doctor appointment that suddenly pops up, they can take you to the doctor appointment. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, sure. Oh, yeah. They really want to play that sort of, you know, large role as to all those unskilled tasks.
Mm-hmm. And normally, you know, if we were in town, you might do it. I might do it. I might run over and work it out and say somebody else can do this. But without children or without family around, I mean, you have to have those other and look to those other resources.
Yeah. So, and to me, it kind of fills out that void that's left. I mean, the care manager I talked about earlier is great, meaning that he or she plays this high level role regarding major decisions, you know, oversight, but yet you need somebody on the ground who can do the things that need to be done. And I spoke to my care manager about Ride at Home, and I said, what do you think about this company? And she said, well, we've worked with them many times, we know, and we've had good experience with them. So she signed off that she thought they made sense. She doesn't have any sort of financial relationship with them, of course. And she's prepared to, when they're not doing something that she notices should be done, she's going to call it to their attention and call it to my attention.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you want, is you really have that advocate for your aunt and uncle when you can't be there.
Yeah.
And I think the other point that you make is talk to different people. Talk to people who know more about this. Find out their experiences. Listen to them and use their guidance and their counsel as you investigate and make these decisions. Sometimes cheapest is not always the best.
That's right. And certainly in this area, it's not the case that cheapest is the best. And so let me add that one other thing importantly is that use the care manager also to help you make decisions about what institutionalized care might be available, whether it's assisted living, independent living, or nursing homes. They can be a huge resource in helping you make these decisions. Boy, we've covered a lot.
We have gone a lot of different directions today.
I've tried to talk fast because I wanted to get through these questions and then pick up on what we felt were between the lines in the questions as well, which we've kind of done this last segment. So, wrapping up another show. See you next week.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.